two takes on the Islamic Revolution, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman is in Tehran, and today he takes the pulse of Iranians who gathered to celebrate the anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, including this young woman.
I wanted to come because I want to prove to the all superpower nations that we will resist to the last breath of our lives.
And we'll hear a different view from an Iranian exile in America.
The revolution failed. So in that sense, it's a bitter memory when your anniversaries come, you know, and go.
And later, the cop who became a carnival star this year in Brazil.
And Mr. Ishii is this Japanese man with gray hair. He always wears these kind of Ray-Ban looking sunglasses. He looks very serious.
Those stories ahead on The World. It's February 11th, the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. A lot's changed in 37 years. For one thing, a lot of the people attending a massive rally today in Tehran weren't even born in 1979. And now there's the nuclear deal between Iran and the West. So what kind of revolution has this become? Marco spent the day speaking with Iranians at the rally to find out.
It's early morning here in Tehran, and a lot of people are heading toward the main gathering point for the rally that will be taking place until about noon today. There are buses parked bumper to bumper up and down this main avenue, and this is how a lot of people came into the city today to take part in this celebration. The rally starts off slow, but the numbers grow quickly. I'm suddenly in a thick current of people heading down the avenue towards Azadi Square. That's where Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, will address the crowd at noon. The first person I meet is Kosar. She's 18, from Tehran. Beneath her black chador is a yellow headband with a line in Farsi that reads, "Lovers of Martyrdom." On the palm of her hand, "Death to America" is written in blue ballpoint pen. Kosar tells me that when the revolution began in 1979, young people in Iran made a promise to follow the supreme leader and commit to the system he created. "We're here this year," she says, "to renew that commitment." The supreme leader is Ali Khamenei, the successor to the late Ayatollah Khomeini. Khamenei is the ultimate political authority in Iran. When I ask Kosar about chanting "Death to America," she says it doesn't mean death to the American people. It's about ending what she says is the U.S. government's hostile policy toward Iran. Then I ask her, what about the nuclear deal between the two countries? Doesn't that change things? She tells me she doesn't make much of the deal, and she's not the only one here who feels that way. That's Syed Mahdi Sajadi. He's 32 and also from Tehran. Syed's wearing a black suit. He's got a black and white keffiyeh scarf around his neck. Syed says the agreement between the U.S. and Iran is only about the nuclear issue. "There are many outstanding issues between the two countries," he continues, "and we haven't resolved them." Then he says, "We will never submit to the United States if it doesn't change its policy toward Iran." By 11 a.m., there are several hundred thousand people here. It's a party atmosphere, with "Death to America" being by far the most common slogan. When someone hears me and my producer speaking English, he asks what country we're from. When we say America, he smiles and says his son is studying in Virginia. A lot of people stop and tell us, "Welcome to Iran." By now, the pace of the march has slowed to baby steps, and I turn around and walk against the current. A 42-year-old schoolteacher in a blue chador and designer sunglasses comes up to me and says she speaks English. She doesn't want to give her name. She says she came to the rally simply because she loves her country.
"I'm independent here, okay? I'm not dependent to other countries. This is the reality for me. And the same as the 37 years before, all the people like the revolution, like the countries and like the leaders."
This woman is a working-class government employee, like many of the Iranians who show up at this anniversary rally every year. They make up the support base for the revolution and the regime. And it makes me wonder whether improving relations, sanctions getting lifted, a potential turnaround in Iran's economy, could all that ever change the impulse to shout "Death to America"? I'll let Kosar, the 18-year-old I met earlier, answer that.
So how many more years will you be here chanting Death to America?
She tells me, matter-of-factly, as long as my supreme leader tells me to come here, and as long as America continues its policies, we will continue chanting this slogan. For the world, Marco Werman, Tehran.
We've got photos from the rally at PRI.org. And be sure to check out Marco's Instagram account for more stories from Iran. You can add your thoughts there using the hashtag Tehran Stories. Now let's get the view of an Iranian living in the U.S. His name is Shahram Agamir. These days, he's a producer with local station KPFA in Berkeley, California. But back in the 1970s, Agamir was in Iran, and he was a supporter of the revolution. Now he lives in exile here. So the anniversary today comes with mixed emotions.
For me, I have ambivalent feelings in general. I see that the Ancien regime was toppled by a mass popular revolution in Iran, and it accomplished political independence vis-a-vis foreign powers. However, when it came to the second component, which has to do with the ability of people to participate in political processes and make decisions for their own future, the revolution failed. So in that sense, it's a bitter memory when your anniversaries come, you know, and go.
Shahram, in the 1970s, you supported the revolution. Take me back to that time. What were you thinking and hoping the revolution would do?
Well, in 1970s, the general sentiment in the society was that there was a lack of political participation by a majority of the society. So that was the general atmosphere of the revolution, pre-revolutionary era. And what you had was, basically this aspiration for change in Iran, you know, the transformation towards a society in which you have a say.
Do you remember how you felt when you started realizing that something was probably going to happen? There was sort of revolutionary murmurings. There was people talking. There were things happening. Do you remember thinking what the revolution might bring to Iran?
Well, it was probably back in 77 that the first signs of potential change started emerging in Iran, and you could notice those signs. First off, there was this great event, actually. There were these nights of poetry reading in Tehran that were well attended. And that kind of indicated the fact that, you know, there could be some breathing space here and room to go ahead and make some, you know, profound changes going to come to the society.
What kind of changes were you hoping for once the revolution took place?
What I was hoping for at that point was to see that individuals in our society were involved in making decisions about their country.
Shahram, it's clear you have sort of mixed feelings about this anniversary and mixed feelings about the revolution. You left Iran in 1978 to attend college in the U.S., and that was before the revolution. Have you ever returned home?
I have not, actually. I was planning to go back, but then in 1980s, there was a period of repression. Essentially, the Islamist regime that came into power, it was unleashing a wave of terror against the opposition. And it has been difficult for some of us in diaspora to go back. Some of us considered what we call self-imposed exile in a way, in different ways. In some ways, some of us are concerned to go back because we're afraid of persecution. It's unclear when you have a security state whether you will be subject to persecution or not. I'm obviously not involved in any political activism, but being vocal and being critical of the regime policies by itself could constitute grounds for persecution in Iran today.
Since the nuclear agreement was signed with Iran and lifting of sanctions, do you feel safer about traveling home?
No, because political repression in Iran is not going to be eased. The authoritarian policies are not, there's no reason to believe that the authoritarian policies of the regime will change.
Shahram Agamir is from Iran. He's a producer for Voices of Middle East and North Africa, a program on KPFA, Pacifica Radio in Berkeley. Thanks, Shahram.
Thank you. You have a good day.
From Iran to another place that's often a thorn in America's side, the border between North and South Korea. There is one place near that border where the two Koreas have tried to play nice, the Kaesong Industrial Zone. It's part of North Korea, but South Korean companies have been allowed to operate there. Today, though, North Korea's military seized the factories and ordered all South Korean workers at Kaesong out. Reporter Jason Strother is in Seoul. What's going on here? This sounds like more than the usual war of words.
Right. Well, North Korea took these steps only after South Korea said that it was going to temporarily halt the operations at the complex. You know, 54,000 North Koreans work there at about 124 South Korean-owned companies. It's a good cash cow, a stream of revenue for the North Korean regime, and they did not take too kindly to Seoul's words that they were going to close down shop.
What was Seoul's reason for closing down the shops?
The South Korean government says the money that North Korea earns, and it's only earned about $560 million since this complex opened in 2004, was going to fund its nuclear weapons program as well as its rocket launch. And as you know, these have been very hot issues over the past month here. It says that this is, you know, will deprive the Kim Jong-un regime of having the resources to further these programs.
So what did North Korea actually do today? Did North Korean soldiers show up at the place?
Once the South Korean workers arrived at the complex today, and there are only a few hundred that went up north, the North Korean military did step in and began ordering the South Koreans out of there. Didn't give them much time to pack. Pretty much they could only take back across the border their personal belongings. All of the assets and products that are made at the complex are now in North Korea's control. And the whole industrial complex is now under the North's military control.
This complex, wasn't this part of a sunshine policy of a previous South Korean leader to try to kind of do a hands across the water, let's all get along kind of thing?
That's right, Carol. And it was the last glimmering bastion of hope here on the Korean Peninsula that there could be better days ahead for the two nations. However, it seems that for now it will be temporarily at best shut down. So the industrial complex was only the last program that had started under President Kim Dae-jung, who initiated the sunshine policy, to let the light shine on North Korea so that it would open up. But the current conservative administration in power here in Seoul, the Park Geun-hye government, has taken a really tough line. And now after the nuclear test and this rocket test, it's looking to cut off any sort of ties with Pyongyang.
So am I correct in imagining, you know, a bunch of factories or shops and North Koreans and South Koreans working side by side and having lunch together and that kind of thing? Or was it more structured and delineated?
Anything in North Korea is structured, but the human contact was definitely something that proponents of the factory championed. They say that because the North Korean workers got exposure to South Korean culture, they interacted with their South Korean bosses and other employees there, that it kind of helped, you know, loosen the mind control that the Pyongyang government has over them. There's no concrete evidence to show that actually worked. But a few years back, there was actually kind of a run on a South Korean snack called choco pies, little chocolate cakes. Evidently, they were very popular at the Kaesong Industrial Complex. The South Korean bosses, give these out to their North Korean employees as gifts. And they were evidently an extremely popular item. So, yeah, in terms of its human contact, the Kaesong Industrial Complex, there were some benefits that came out of it.
Reporter Jason Strother in Seoul. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Yesterday, we brought you a story about family farmers in Brazil who are supplying ingredients for school meals and making a better living doing it. Today, another way to get cheaper, healthier meals to school kids in Brazil, public schools that grow their own vegetables. Ritu Chatterjee reports from Sao Paulo.
The garden sits at the top of a hilly slope behind the Leao Machado School. A few of the plots have herbs, cabbages, and some garlic growing in them. Most are empty. But a group of sixth graders is here to change that. They're armed with seed, soil, and a range of gardening tools. They're accompanied by two young teachers, Daniel Giglio Colombo and Marta Martins.
Vinicius, Henrique, Pedro.
Martins calls out the students' names and divides them into three groups. A boy named Felipe Pigato tells me they're preparing the soil for planting.
We mix regular soil with coconut fiber. The coconut fiber holds the seeds in the soil.
Today, he says, they'll add in the compost. Then they start digging.
Lots of earthworms coming out as they dig. Worms?
That's 12-year-old Matheus Vitosa de Almeida. He points to an earthworm and slowly pulls back the soil around it.
We have to pull them out like that so we don't hurt the worms. If we take them out, it's bad for the soil.
Two other students push a wheelbarrow with a large sack in it. The kids pour in the compost and mix it with the soil. Their teacher, Daniel Giglio Colombo, tells me this is the second year of the project. He points to a couple of students in the background. They're not joining in. He says some kids don't want to work with the soil in the beginning of the year.
By mid-year, we start to see some changes in their habits. They are not that resistant anymore.
They even start enjoying the process, he says, and the vegetables they grow are used in school meals. But later, he tells me the aim of the school garden isn't to supply ingredients, but to teach students where food comes from, to help them develop a connection to their food.
When we ask the students where lettuce comes from, they say the market. They have lost contact with nature, the soil, sowing and growing crops.
And that, he says, is reflected in their diets, which are increasingly unhealthy. Just like in the US, highly processed foods, fast food, soda, high fructose corn syrup, have become all too popular here in Brazil. And obesity rates are rising as a result, even among children. It's a nationwide problem. That's why the Brazilian government has banned sodas, cakes and cookies in school meals and restricted the amount of salt and sugar in them as well. It also requires at least one daily serving of fruits and vegetables. But Colombo's colleague Marta Martin says initially students used to reject fresh food. She hoped the school garden would change that.
We wanted to create better habits. We wanted them to improve their eating and become healthier.
And that idea is behind the flourishing of school gardens across Brazil. The program started 12 years ago as a pilot project in 5 schools. Today, there are a few thousand school gardens in 700 cities and towns, and the government plans more. Albanete Peixinho ran Brazil's school meal program for 13 years. She says it's hard to know whether school gardens have improved children's health yet, but schools report that the gardens have made students more aware of their food. And she says they're eating healthier. She says some studies even show that the students are influencing how their families eat.
Parents say that the kids are eating a lot of fruits and vegetables, and they insist on eating those foods at home.
Back at the Leão Machado School, I meet Sara Campos, a 14-year-old who took the school garden class last year.
Eu nunca tinha comido rabanete.
I've never eaten radishes before.
But she did try some when she and her classmates cooked radishes they had grown.
I loved it so much that I even had a second plate.
Now, she says she eats radishes often.
I ask my mom to make them for lunch sometimes. It's very good.
She and her classmates tell me they're more open to eating vegetables now. They try to avoid fast food and they're more conscious of their diets. Out in the garden, I ask Matheus, the student who told me about earthworms, what he has learned in his gardening class.
Many things like digging, what organic fertilizer is, what animals do to make the soil better.
What did you learn about vegetables?
That they are good for our health and well-being.
Do you eat vegetables?
I'm not so keen on them, but I guess I do now with this project.
And by the end of the school year, he may really enjoy them. For the world, Ritu Chatterjee, Sao Paulo, Brazil.
Rito's reporting was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Let's stay in Brazil for a bit. Carnival's over, but the music lives on. The annual party inspired some creative songs this year. Catherine Osborne's been hanging out with carnival goers in Rio.
Carnival is always interesting because in addition to celebrating Brazilian identity, you also get a read on politics and what people are talking about. There are classic carnival songs and they're rewritten with satirical lyrics and some new songs are composed. This year, the satire talked about anti-corruption investigations. It talked about the Olympics coming up, rowing in dirty water. It talked about the Zika virus and about a bill that's in Congress that would restrict abortion access. Some of the themes are pretty heavy, but since Brazil's dictatorship, Carnival's always been an important place and relatively safe space to have dissent.
One of the puppets featured on the streets this year was of a man named Newton Ishii, a middle-aged police officer of Japanese descent. Who is he?
That was in Olinda, which is a city which is famous for its huge puppets. Mr. Ishii is a police officer who a lot of Brazilians have seen on television and in photos because he accompanies people who are being investigated in a big anti-corruption probe right now as they get perp walked from their house, or sometimes they were already in prison for another crime and they're just getting moved to a deposition room. But Mr. Ishii usually accompanies them. And Mr. Ishii is this Japanese man with gray hair. He always wears these kind of Ray-Ban looking sunglasses. He looks very serious. And so people started to notice him and say, hey, who is that person?
I understand there's even a song written about him.
The song says, the Japanese police officer knocked on my door and he came and he said, come here, you're going to go to Paraná. And Paraná is where the anti-corruption probe is based. So if you're going to Paraná, you're in trouble. And it says, I told the police officer that you got the wrong person because I'm not a lobbyist, senator, or congressman, which just tells you the kind of people who are getting investigated in this. Real power players in Brazilian society.
Catherine, did I read correctly that Mr. Ishii's bosses have kind of relieved him from his frontline visible duty of walking perps?
Yes. If it's a carnival song that you are going to get arrested when the Japanese police officer comes to your door, probably he's lost some of the element of surprise. I think he has more of a behind-the-desk function these days.
Catherine Osborne, reporting from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Two Latinos are running for president. Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are both Cuban Americans. So why aren't Latino voters more excited about them?
They don't feel represented because they don't think the families of Senator Cruz or Senator Rubio really felt the same immigrant experience that they did.
That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. Last week, Senator Ted Cruz made history. He won in Iowa, becoming the first Hispanic candidate ever to win a presidential caucus or primary. Cruz is Cuban-American, so too is Marco Rubio. Both Rubio and Cruz refer to their heritage on the campaign trail, but their Cuban backgrounds play very different roles in their candidacies, according to Miami Herald reporter Patricia Mazzei. For starters, she notes, Cruz didn't grow up in a Cuban culture.
He grew up more as a Texan. I mean, he changed his nickname as a teenager. His full name is Rafael Edward Cruz, and he used to be known as Felito, which is a nickname for Rafael. His father has the same name. And as a teenager, he decided to change it, to anglicize his name to Ted after his middle name, Edward. And so there was obviously an identity shift there. He doesn't speak good Spanish. You know, he calls it lousy.
Does he tout his Cuban-American background?
He talks about his father's journey to the United States, seeking freedoms that he didn't have in Cuba. But I don't think he talks about being culturally Hispanic. He has been asked about Spanish music, which was an interview that did not sit well, kind of to prove your Hispanicness, you know, never sits well with the Latino community. But Cruz himself has said, you know, I grew up listening to country. I mean, it's just culturally a very different vision of things, even though he likes, you know, Cuban food and talks about his half-siblings who are Cuban.
Does the fact that Cruz is Hispanic mean much to Latinos?
Well, that's where I think the real interesting part of this is. He became the first Latino to win the Iowa caucuses, and that is historic. However, you did not hear a lot of celebration from the Latino community. And the people I've spoken to suggest that that's because they don't see him culturally as Latino, and they don't see him speaking to their needs as Latinos. So what makes someone Hispanic? Is it having a last name like Cruz and a father who is Cuban? Because that certainly fits the definition. Or is there something beyond that about speaking culturally for a people who feel a lot more connected to their roots than Senator Cruz appears to.
And Marco Rubio, the Cuban American community has embraced him in a different way.
Marco Rubio grew up in Miami to both a Cuban mother and father, and they also left Cuba before the Cuban Revolution. And when you grow up in South Florida, you are surrounded by other Cuban exiles. So the Cuban culture is ingrained in who he is, and some would argue really helped him get to where he is now.
In the case of Marco Rubio, does his sensibility, his politics represent a kind of older Cuban immigrant view of the world versus the younger crowd who's coming up and don't agree with everything their immigrant parents believed?
Some would argue both Cruz and Rubio represent kind of the older Cuban exile view of things. The immigration from more recent years has been more economic exiles with kind of a different set of priorities.
It's been observed that both Cruz and Rubio, they're immigrants, yet they seem to be anti-immigrant in their policies. How does that sit with Latinos?
Cubans are treated differently under U.S. law for immigration purposes. There is a law called the Cuban Adjustment Act that allows Cubans who are in the U.S. for a year and a day to apply for permanent residency and later for citizenship. And so there is some resentment among Latino communities who are not Cubans that Cubans were treated that way. And they don't feel represented because they don't think the families of Senator Cruz or Senator Rubio really felt the same immigrant experience that they did. I did some reporting last year out of Las Vegas in the old neighborhood where Senator Rubio spent some years of his youth, and it is largely Mexican-American now. And he sounds like a Cuban there, you know? He doesn't look the same as the people there. And so that is something that we're going to have to see down the road if just their name, and in Senator Rubio's case, the fact that he speaks their language, is enough to speak for more Latino voters, or is he just going to appeal to Cuban Americans who are a pretty narrow percentage of the U.S. population?
Didn't Marco Rubio famously check the box white instead of Hispanic in his application to renew his Florida driver's license?
Yes, and that's not inaccurate, right? Because race and ethnicity are different things. And so you can be a white Hispanic or a black Hispanic. It's one of those misconceptions that the U.S. Census actually fixed some years ago where they separate the two categories. And I guess at the time, Florida had not changed that in its demographic information. But he's not wrong. He is white. He's also Hispanic. And so it's one of those things where, you know, your identity is made up of many things.
But what role does race play here? I mean, it plays some role in the Latino population, which itself is very diverse.
I did interview Cristina Garcia, who is a Cuban-American novelist who lives in California. And she noted that you have someone like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio. They are white males. They don't sound different. They don't have an accent. So perhaps that makes them harder to relate to people as Hispanics, because you don't think of it right away when you see them. It's not like with President Obama that his race shows him to be different from all the other presidents who came before him. If they were Afro-Latinos, would Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio be making a different impact on the race? It's quite possible. I mean, these are the kind of textured nuances of American politics that we have not seen play out because we've never had Hispanics get this far in the presidential nomination.
Miami Herald reporter Patricia Mazzei, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
From Cuban-American politicians to one of the great singers of Afro-Cuban music, let's take a few minutes to talk about Melon. He died on Monday at the age of 85 in Mexico City. Beto Arcos remembers him as the Mexican who made Cuban music come alive.
How could I forget the first time I heard Lobo y Melón on the radio back in the late 1960s in my hometown of Jalapa, Veracruz? It was a Cuban song called Amalia Batista. Here was a Mexican duo singing a Cuban tune, but something was different. Lobo y Melón made it their own with direct references to Mexican music. Luis Ángel Silva was his real name, but we all knew him as Melón. And I think he was the best Mexican sonero, a singer with the ability to improvise. And when he improvised, he made Cuban music accessible to a wide Mexican audience. Another reason I like Melón so much was his singular style. The way he danced and the way he played maracas, that was something I'd never seen before. I thought he was one cool cat. Here's Melón and his band on Mexican TV in the 1960s performing Cuba's anthem, Guantanamera.
Guantanamera, Guajira Guantanamera. Guantanamera, Guajira Guantanamera.
A few years ago, I got a hold of the two albums he recorded with one of the superstars of New York's salsa scene, the great Johnny Pacheco. And one of the tunes they recorded is my all-time favorite anthem written by Agustin Lara, Veracruz. Now, this is one exceptional version. Take a listen.
Veracruz, son tus noches diluvio de estrellas, palmera y mujer. Veracruz, vibra en mi ser. Algún día tus playas lejanas tendré que volver.
¿Dónde? Tendré que volver.
Yo tenía mi cascabel con una cinta morada. Con una cinta morada yo tenía mi cascabel. Y como era de oropel, se lo di a mi prenda amada, pa' que jugara con él. Allá por la madrugada, ay, como resumba y suena, resumba y va resumbando, resumba y va resumbando mi cascabel en la arena.
Tendré que volver.
You see, Melon is part of a golden age of tropical music in Mexico in the 1950s and 60s, when Mexico was at the heart of it all. Melon was the sort of musical bridge between Mexico and Cuba, and his passing represents the end of an era. He reminded us that Mexico is also part of the Caribbean, and that we share a musical culture. This resonated strongly with me, since Veracruz was the port of entry for all the Cuban music I grew up listening to: danzón, bolero, mambo, cha-cha-cha, and son. Over the years, I've heard people say that Mexico never had much of an Afro-Cuban music scene. But Melon's rich career is proof that Mexico not only had a popular tropical music scene, but was a launching pad for the careers of many important figures of Afro-Cuban music. And Melon helped to pave the way. For the world, I'm Beto Arcos.
Secretary of State John Kerry isn't having a great week. He's in Munich, Germany for an international conference on Syria, and he's getting flack from all sides, including old allies. Kerry's French counterpart lambasted America's ambiguous policy on Syria. Meanwhile, Turkey's asking the U.S., whose side are you on anyway? Josh Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Josh, there's so much going on here, but let's focus on one ally in particular, Turkey. Why is Turkey so unhappy with the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. strategy in Syria is to arm up the Kurds in order to fight ISIS. And the Kurds in Syria, about 10% of the population, the dominant Kurdish group is the PYD. And they are an arm of the Turkish Kurdish group, PKK, which is the Kurdish Workers' Party. Turkey considers them a terrorist organization. Now, America recently explained to Turkey that it does not view the Syrian Kurds, the PYD, as a terrorist organization, only the PKK. And this led Erdogan to make his statement. He said, how can we trust you? And he said, is it me that is your partner, or is it the terrorists in Kobani? Kobani is the major city in Syrian Kurdish region.
And of course, Erdogan is the Turkish president.
And Erdogan is the Turkish president. And the Turkish president has said, guns that you are supplying to this Kurdish group in Syria are flowing right across the border, and they're being used to kill Turkish policemen and military guys. And a war has opened up between the Kurds in Turkey and the Turkish government. And that's what has Erdogan terribly frightened. It's dividing Turkey. Some 15 to 20% of Turks or Kurds. And this is a real problem for him and his presidency.
And is that true, that the arms that the U.S. is providing to Syrian Kurds are in fact ending up in eastern Turkey with Turkish Kurds and being used on Turks?
Well, the Americans are denying that. They say that they're watching the border, but they can't be watching the border. Of course these arms are going to go across borders. We've seen this already. You know, America accuses Turkey of exactly the same thing, of letting jihadists flow across the border. So both sides have been furious at the other in supporting what they call terrorists.
And it's serious because the U.S. needs Turkey. Turkey's a key ally, isn't that correct?
Completely key. Turkey has a border of 500 miles long with Syria, a border with Iraq. Turkey's a member of NATO. They're an old and important ally. We need Turkey as an ally. We cannot forsake them. We don't want to forsake them, but we need to destroy ISIS, and that is our dilemma, and we don't have good Arab allies to do it. And the larger backdrop to this is that Turkey wants the United States to come in strong on Syria, stop the Russians, and stop the refugee flow that's pouring out of Aleppo. Turkey feels like it's been left holding the bag, both by the United States and Europe. We've done nothing to stop the flow of refugees and to stop Assad in Syria, and Europe is now shutting its borders and won't take any more refugees, and they're just collecting in Turkey. And Erdogan is furious. He can only see trouble on the horizon, and he wants America to help him fix it.
A lot of the anger toward John Kerry is that the U.S. simply, as you said, hasn't really stepped up with anything focused, any real military might to try to vanquish ISIS or Assad, for that matter.
Yeah.
Do you see any indication that the U.S. is going to change its policy, given that its current kind of wait and see for a political solution is simply not working?
I do not. I think, you know, President Obama was very clear. September 30th, when the Russians went into Syria, he said, we are not going to fight a proxy war with Russia for Syria. And that meant he was going to stand on the side. And every presidential candidate that looks like they might win in this new election cycle, none of them have said they're going to go in and fix Syria. So it looks very bad from a Turkish point of view. America looks like it's bowing out. It's going to let Russia try to clean up Syria or at least have its way in Syria. And Turkey is furious because it placed a big bet on backing the rebels. It thought it had America behind it and destroying Assad. It looks today that Assad may reconquer the country and establish his authority. The Kurds then would have a backer in Syria and a large degree of autonomy, and that would put Turkey in a terrible position.
Josh Landis is a Syria expert at the University of Oklahoma. Thanks, Josh.
It's a pleasure talking with you.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. It's not every day you get to say something like this. There's big news today about gravity. For the first time ever, scientists say they've detected long, elusive gravity waves. Here's The World's Ari Daniel.
Gravity. You know it as what holds things together. It holds us to the Earth, holds the Earth in orbit around the Sun. But what exactly is gravity? More than 300 years ago, Isaac Newton said that any two objects that have mass are attracted to each other by a force.
And that force is what Newton called gravity.
And, says Priya Natarajan, an astrophysicist at Yale, that's how things stayed for over 200 years, until Albert Einstein showed up.
Einstein thought about gravity in a fundamentally different way.
And here's where things get fun. I want you to close your eyes. Unless you're driving, then keep your eyes open. Imagine a large rubber sheet, like a trampoline. Now drop a large metal ball onto it. The ball causes the sheet to bend, forming a dimple. The bigger the ball, the bigger the dimple. Okay, scale it up. Now the ball is the sun, and it's sitting not on a rubber sheet, but rather in a four-dimensional fabric, what Einstein called space-time.
Masses like the Earth or the sun bend the space-time around them, and by bending the space-time around them, they effectively attract nearby objects.
This, says MIT physicist Matthew Evans, is how Einstein understood gravity. He saw it as one of the fundamental forces of our universe. But here's the thing. Even though it's the force that's most obvious in our lives, it turns out that gravity is actually the weakest. So to see it at work, you need something really dramatic, something that creates massive ripples in space-time, like waves moving out from a rock dropped in a pond. In fact, Einstein called these gravity waves. But while Einstein predicted gravity waves, he never observed them. The tools just didn't exist. Until today.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have detected gravitational waves. We did it.
This morning, a team of researchers 1,000 strong from the U.S. and around the world announced the first ever direct detection of gravity waves. Gabriela Gonzalez is a physicist at Louisiana State University and a spokesperson for the project, which is called LIGO.
It's just exhilarating. Here we detected the space-time around us wobbling, getting distorted, compressed, and stretched for a fraction of a second.
Now, how these gravity waves were detected is nothing short of incredible. The LIGO team built two giant L-shaped detectors in Louisiana and Washington State. The arm of each L is 2.5 miles long.
The arms of this L are these concrete bunkers.
That's Matthew Evans again. He's one of the researchers on the project. Evans and his team have tested equipment for the LIGO project in their lab at MIT. The lab's about the size of a basketball court, with a giant metal tube with a laser in it. In the real LIGO bunkers, the lasers would measure the precise lengths of those 2.5 mile arms.
So if there were no gravity waves, they would have the same length?
Astrophysicist Priya Natarajan.
But if it turns out, because of gravity waves causing a jiggle, one of the arms is going to have a slightly different length.
Slightly is actually a bit of an understatement.
We're talking about a fraction of the diameter of a proton. That's why it's so challenging.
Yeah, it is kind of crazy.
And yet, despite the crazy, Matthew Evans and his colleagues did it. The LIGO team used those L-shaped buildings to detect gravity waves that were produced by a collision of two black holes more than 1 billion light years away. It's the first time we've observed this violent phenomenon in the universe, ever.
It's as if we had an enormous hearing aid, which let us pick up this sounds that the universe has been producing. We just have been deaf to these sounds.
That's it, actually. The gravity waves generated by the two black holes spiraling towards each other, converted into sound and sped up. It's quick. I'll play it again. The collision sent gravity waves rippling outwards at the speed of light. More than 1 billion years later, they passed through the Earth and made the arms of the detectors in Louisiana and Washington change their lengths ever so slightly. Okay, this is all kind of mind-bending stuff, but really, what's the big deal?
It's like opening a new window into the universe.
You see, up until now, we've studied the stars and outer space using only electromagnetic radiation.
But gravitational waves are the first step to some completely new way of looking at the universe.
And here's the other reason this is a big deal.
Because gravity waves are not obscured by anything, we can see right through to the edge of the universe.
And that means we might be able to get closer than ever to observing the earliest moments of time, just after the Big Bang, and closer than ever to understanding how the universe came to be.
I actually never imagined that in my lifetime that window would open.
That window opens up all kinds of exciting possibilities. But let's return to today. Because it's not every day that we get to literally hear the universe confirm something first conjured up on paper 100 years ago.
It is really hard not to be completely in awe of Einstein, that this theory came completely out of his pure thought.
Today we have new proof for that theory. It's a day worth celebrating. And when the confetti falls, we now have a little better idea of why. For the world, I'm Ari Daniel.
Finally today, a Latin note. In some ways, learning this ancient language has never been easier or more fun. How do I conjugate the verb for to love?
Amor, amas, amat.
Amamus, amatis, amat.
And YouTube's got plenty of funny videos that help you with that pesky grammar. It's true, the technology's different. But over the years, the way we've learned Latin hasn't changed all that much. Eleanor Dickey of Britain's Reading University has written a book on how Latin was taught during Roman times. Back then, of course, it was a must-learn if you wanted to get ahead. Dickey studied fragments of Latin textbooks.
I mean, there's so many ways in which these books look like our foreign language teaching material. So if you learn French, you're going to get a book with little dialogues about someone going to a cafe and ordering a sandwich. And it's so striking how these little dialogues are the ancient equivalent of that. And you think, gosh, they were just like us. And then you look more closely at the details and you think, wait a minute, they were not like us.
For example, Dickey came across a lesson that taught this phrase.
I can't do it now. I have to take a bath.
Sounds straightforward enough, but read on and you'll find a much different definition of bath.
Everybody was bathing regularly in the same very small pool of water. And before they bathed, they rolled around in the mud and covered themselves with oil. It turns out from these texts, you have to scrape yourself with a metal scraper to get the gunk off before you can dry yourself with a towel.
Ah, the good old days. For more stories about languages, check out our podcast, The World in Words. You can find it at iTunes.
I'm a scented seeker, tagged for stick and tear. Quamodo, we're optimist today, hawk. Quamodo, we're optimist today, hawk.
This is a Latin version of a recent British hit called Pompeii. And that ends the show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.